saving money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 26 colors of Owens Corning Duration shingles and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator. And hell, I might as well add drug dealer to that list, since tonight's episode is going to make you wonder if you took a dose of something and forgot about it. You see, friends, our story submission pipeline had another hiccup this week, and it fell onto me, fairly late in the game, to find some stories for you fine folks. We've already delved into Chambers and Lovecraft recently, so I wanted to cover something a bit off the beaten path. Well, luckily, or unluckily for you, I have in front of me two of the most batshit insane tales ever. This episode is going to feel more like a Saturday morning cartoon block than a weeknight horror show. We've got explorers, we've got lost worlds, we've got mad scientists, and boy, oh boy, do we have dinosaurs. Our features tonight are The Monster of Lake Lemaitre by Warden Alan Curtis and The Day of the Dragon by Guy Endor. I'll skip the synopses tonight since both of these stories benefit from going in blind. But I'd ask, dear listeners, that you pay attention to your own expectations as we go through them. As I was reading them, both elicited moments where I thought, wait, there's no way they're going to actually... And then they did, and then I laughed. Heartily. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Warden Alan Curtis, I give you The Monster of Lake Lemaitre. To Professor Wilhelm G. Breyfogle, University of Tacobera. Dear friend, enclosed, you will find some portions of the diary it's been my lifelong custom to keep, arranged in such a manner as to narrate connectedly the history of some remarkable occurrences that have taken place here during the last 3 years. Years and years ago, I heard vague accounts of a strange lake high up in an almost inaccessible part of the mountains of Wyoming. Various incredible tales were related of it, such as that it was inhabited by creatures which elsewhere on the globe are found only as fossils of a long-vanished time. The lake and its surroundings are of volcanic origin, and not the least strange thing about the lake is that it's subject to periodic disturbances, which take the form of a mighty boiling in the center, as if a tremendous artesian well were rushing up there from the bowels of the earth. The lake rises for a time, almost filling the basin of black rocks in which it rests, and then recedes, leaving on the shores mollusks and trunks of strange trees and bits of strange ferns which no longer grow, on the earth at least, and are to be seen elsewhere only in coal measures and beds of stone. And he who casts hook and line into the dusky waters may haul forth ganoid fishes completely covered with bony plates. All of this is described in the account written by Father Lemaitre years ago, and he there advances the theory that the earth is hollow and that its interior is inhabited by the forms of plant and animal life which disappeared from its surface ages ago, and that the lake connects with this interior region. Syme's theory of polar orifices is well known to you. It is amply corroborated. I know now that it's true. Through the great holes at the poles, the sun sends light and heat into the interior. 3 years ago this month, I found my way through the mountains here to Lake Lemaitre, accompanied by a single companion, our friend, young Edward Framingham. He was led to go with me not so much by scientific fervor as by the faint hope that his health might be improved by sojourn in the mountains, for he suffered from an acute form of dyspepsia that, at times, drove him frantic. Beneath an overhanging scarp of the wall of rock surrounding the lake, we found a rudely built stone house left by the old cliff dwellers. Though somewhat drafty, it would keep out the infrequent rains of the region and serve well enough as a shelter for the short time which we intended to stay. The extracts from my diary follow. April 29th, 1896. I've been occupied during the past few days in gathering specimens of the various plants which are cast upon the shore by the waves of this remarkable lake. Framingham does nothing but fish and claims that he has discovered the place where the lake communicates with the interior of the earth, if indeed it does, and there seems to be little doubt of that. While fishing at a point near the center of the lake, he let down three pickerel lines tied together, in all nearly 300 feet, without finding bottom. Coming ashore, he collected every bit of line, string, strap, and rope in our possession and made a line 500 feet long, and still he was unable to find the bottom. May 2nd, evening. The past 3 days have been profitably spent in securing specimens and mounting and pickling them for preservation. Framingham has had a bad attack of dyspepsia this morning and is not very well. Change of climate had a brief effect for the better upon his malady, but seems to have exhausted its force much sooner than one would have expected, and he lies on his couch of dry water weeds, moaning piteously. I shall take him back to civilization as soon as he's able to be moved. It is very annoying to have to leave when I have scarcely begun to probe the mysteries of the place. I wish Framingham had not come with me. The lake is roaring wildly without, which is strange, as it's been perfectly calm hitherto, and still more strange because I can neither feel nor hear the rushing of the wind, though perhaps that's because it's blowing from the south and we're protected from it by the cliff. But in that case, there ought to be no waves on this shore. The roaring seems to grow louder momentarily. Framingham. May 3rd, morning. Such a night of terror we've been through. Last evening, as I sat writing in my diary, I heard a sudden hiss and, looking down, saw wriggling across the earthen floor what I at first took to be a serpent of some kind, and then discovered was a stream of water, which, coming in contact with the fire, had caused the startling hiss. In a moment, other streams had darted in, and before I had collected my senses enough to move, the water was 2 inches deep everywhere and steadily rising. Now I knew the cause of the roaring, and rousing Framingham, I half-dragged him, half-carried him to the door, and digging our feet into the chinks of the wall of the house, we climbed up to its top. There was nothing else to do, for above us and behind us was the unscalable cliff, and on each side the ground sloped away rapidly, and it would have been impossible to reach the high ground at the entrance to the basin. After a time, we lighted matches, for with all this commotion, there was little air stirring, and we could see the water, now halfway up the side of the house, rushing to the west with the force and velocity of the current of a mighty river, and every little while it hurled tree trunks against the house walls with a terrific shock that threatened to batter them down. After an hour or so, the roaring began to decrease, and finally there was an absolute silence. The water, which had raised to within a foot of where we sat, was at rest, neither rising nor falling. Presently, a faint whispering began and became a stertorous breathing, and then a rushing like that of the wind and a roaring rapidly increasing in volume. And the lake was in motion again, but this time the water and its swirling freight of tree trunks flowed by the house toward the east and was constantly falling, and out in the center of the lake, the beams of the moon were darkly reflected by the sides of a huge whirlpool, streaking the surface of polished blackness down, down, down the vortex, into the beginning of whose terrible depths we looked from our high perch. This morning, the lake is back at its usual level. Our mules are drowned, our boat destroyed, our food damaged, my specimens and some of my instruments injured, and Framingham is very ill. We shall have to depart soon, although I dislike exceedingly to do so, as the disturbance of last night, which is clearly like the one described by Father Lemaitre, has undoubtedly brought up from the bowels of the earth some strange and interesting things. Indeed, out in the middle of the lake where the whirlpool subsided, I can see a large quantity of floating things, logs and branches, most of them probably. But who knows what else? Through my glass, I can see a tree trunk, or rather stump, of enormous dimensions. From its width, I judged that the whole tree must have been as large as some of the Californian big trees. The main part of it appears to be about 10 feet wide and 30 feet long. Projecting from it and lying prone on the water is a limb, or root, some 15 feet long and perhaps 2 or 3 feet thick. Before we leave, which will be as soon as Framingham is able to go, I shall make a raft and visit the mass of driftwood, unless the wind providentially sends it ashore. May 4th, evening. A day of most remarkable and wonderful occurrences. When I arose this morning and looked through my glass, I saw that the mass of driftwood still lay in the middle of the lake, motionless on the glassy surface. But the great black stump had disappeared. I was sure it was not hidden by the rest of the driftwood, for yesterday it lay some distance from the other logs, and there had been no disturbance of wind or water to change its position. I therefore concluded that it was some heavy wood that needed to become but slightly waterlogged to cause it to sink. Framingham having fallen asleep at about 10, I sallied forth to look along the shores for specimens, carrying with me a botanical can and a South American machete, which I have possessed since a visit to Brazil 3 years ago, where I learned the usefulness of this saber-like thing. The shore was strewn with bits of strange plants and shells, and I was stooping to pick one up when suddenly I felt my clothes plucked and heard a snap behind me, and turning about, I saw... But I won't describe it until I tell what I did, for I did not fairly see the terrible creature until I had swung my machete round and sliced off the top of its head, and then tumbled down into the shallow water where I lay almost fainting. Here was the black log I had seen in the middle of the lake, a monstrous elasmosaurus, and high above me on the heaps of rocks lay the thing's head with its long jaws crowded with saber-like teeth, and its enormous eyes as big as saucers. I wondered that it did not move, for I expected a series of convulsions, but no sound of a commotion was heard from the creature's body, which lay out of my sight on the other side of the rocks. I decided that my sudden cut had acted like a stunning blow and produced a sort of coma, and fearing lest the beast should recover the use of its muscles before death fully took place, and in its agony roll away into the deep water where I could not secure it, I hastily removed the brain entirely, performing the operation neatly, though with some trepidation, and, restoring to the head the detached segment cut off by my machete, I proceeded to examine my prize. In length of body, it was exactly 28 feet. In the widest part, it is 8 feet through laterally, and is some 6 feet through from back to belly. 4 great flippers, rudimentary arms and feet, and an immensely long, sinuous, swan-like neck complete the creature's body. Its head is very small for the size of the body and is very round, and a pair of long jaws project in front, much like a duck's bill. Its skin is a leathery integument of a lustrous black, and its eyes are enormous hazel optics with a soft, melancholy stare in their liquid depths. It is an Elasmosaurus, one of the largest of antediluvian animals. Whether of the same species as those whose bones have been discovered, I cannot say. My examination finished, I hastened after framing him, for I was certain that this waif from a long past age would arouse almost any invalid. I found him somewhat recovered from his attack of the morning, and he eagerly accompanied me to the Elasmosaurus. In examining the animal afresh, I was astonished to find that its heart was still beating, and that all the functions of the body, except thought, were being performed 1 hour after the thing had received its death blow. But I knew that the hearts of sharks have been known to beat for hours after being removed from the body, and that decapitated frogs live and have all the powers of motion for weeks after their heads have been cut off. I removed the top of the head to look into it, and here another surprise awaited me, for the edges of the wound were granulating and preparing to heal. The color of the interior of the skull was perfectly healthy and natural. There was no undue flow of blood, and there was every evidence that the animal intended to get well and live without a brain. Looking at the interior of the skull, I was struck by its resemblance to a human skull. In fact, it is, as nearly as I can judge, the size and shape of the brain pan of an ordinary man who wears a 7 1/8 hat. Examining the brain itself, I found it to be the size of an ordinary human brain, and singularly like it in general contour, though it's very inferior in fiber and has few convolutions. May 5th, morning. Framingham is exceedingly ill and talks of dying, declaring that if a natural death does not put an end to his sufferings, he will commit suicide. I do not know what to do. All my attempts to encourage him are of no avail, and the few medicines I have no longer fit his case at all. May 5th, evening. I have just buried Framingham's body in the sand of the lake shore. I performed no ceremonies over the grave, for perhaps the real Framingham is not dead, though such speculation seems utterly wild. Tomorrow I shall erect a cairn upon the mound, unless, indeed, there are signs that my experiment is successful, though it's foolish to hope that it will be. At 10 this morning, Framingham's qualms left him, and he set forth with me to see the Elasmosaurus. The creature lay in the place where we left it yesterday, its position unaltered, still breathing, all the bodily functions performing themselves. The wound in its head had healed a great deal during the night, and I dare say will be completely healed within a week or so, such is the rapidity with which these reptilian organisms repair damage to themselves. Collecting 3 or 4 bushels of mussels, I shelled them and poured them down the Elasmosaurus's throat. With a convulsive gasp, they passed down, and the great mouth slowly closed. "How long do you expect to keep the reptile alive?" asked Framingham. "Until I've gotten word to a number of scientific friends, and they've come here to examine it. I shall take you to the nearest settlement and write letters from there. Returning, I shall feed the Elasmosaurus regularly until my friends come and we decide what final disposition to make of it. We shall probably stuff it." "But you'll have trouble in killing it unless you hack it to pieces, and that won't do." "Oh, if I only had the vitality of that animal. There's a monster whose vitality is so splendid that the removal of its brain does not disturb it. I should feel very happy if someone would remove my body. If I only had some of that beast's useless strength." "In your case, the possession of a too active brain has injured the body," said I. "Too much brain exercise and too little bodily exercise are the causes of your trouble. It would be a pleasant thing if you had the robust health of the Elasmosaurus, but what a wonderful thing it would be if that mighty engine had your intelligence." I turned away to examine the reptile's wounds, for I had brought my surgical instruments with me and intended to dress them. I was interrupted by a burst of groans from Framingham, and turning, beheld him rolling on the sand in agony. I hastened to him, but before I could reach him, he seized my case of instruments and, taking the largest and sharpest knife, cut his throat from ear to ear.
Framing him! Framing him!
I shouted, and to my astonishment, he looked at me intelligently. I recalled the case of the French doctor who, for some minutes after being guillotined, answered his friends by winking.
If you hear me, wink! I cried.
The right eye closed and opened with a snap. Ah, here the body was dead and the brain lived. I glanced at the Elasmosaurus. Its mouth, half closed over its gleaming teeth, seemed to smile an invitation. The intelligence of the man and the strength of the brain. The living body and the living brain. The curious resemblance of the reptile's brain pan to that of a man flashed across my mind. Are you still alive, Framingham? The right eye winked. I seized my machete, for there was no time for delicate instruments. I might destroy all by haste and roughness, but I was sure to destroy all by delay. I opened the skull and disclosed the brain. I had not injured it, and breaking the wound of the Elasmosaurus's head, placed the brain within. I dressed the wound and, hurrying to the house, brought all my store of stimulants and administered them. For years, the medical fraternity has been predicting that brain grafting will sometime be successfully accomplished. Why has it never been successfully accomplished? Because it has not been tried. Obviously, a brain from a dead body cannot be used, and what living man would submit to the horrible process of having his head opened and portions of his brain taken for the use of others? The brains of men are frequently examined when injured and parts of the brain removed, but parts of the brains of other men have never been substituted for the parts removed. No uninjured man has ever been found who would give any portion of his brain for the use of another. Until criminals under sentence of death are handed over to science for experimentation, we shall not know what can be done in the way of brain grafting. But public opinion would never allow it. Conditions are favorable for a fair and thorough trial of my experiment. The weather is cool and even, and the wound in the head of the Elasmosaurus has every chance for healing. The animal possesses a vitality superior to any of our later-day animals, and if any organism can successfully become the host of a foreign brain, nourishing and cherishing it, the Elasmosaurus, with its abundant vital forces, can do it. It may be that a new era in the history of the world will begin here.
May 6th, noon. I think I will allow my experiment a little more time. May 7th, noon.
It cannot be imagination. I am sure that as I looked into the Elasmosaurus's eyes this morning, there was expression in them. Dim, it's true, a sort of mistiness that floats over them like the reflection of passing clouds.
May 8th, noon.
I am more sure than yesterday that there is expression in the eyes, a look of troubled fear, such as is seen in the eyes of those who dream nightmares with unclosed lids.
May 11th, evening. I have been ill and have not seen the Elasmosaurus for 3 days, but I shall be better able to judge the progress of the experiment by remaining away a period of some duration.
May 12th, noon.
I am overcome with awe as I realize the success that has so far crowned my experiment. As I approached the Elasmosaurus this morning, I noticed a faint disturbance in the water near its flippers. I cautiously investigated, expecting to discover some fishes nibbling at the helpless monster, and saw that the commotion was not due to fishes, but to the flippers themselves, which were feebly moving.
"Framingham! Framingham!"
I bawled at the top of my voice. The vast bulk stirred a little, a very little, but enough to notice. Is the brain, or framing him, it would perhaps be better to say, asleep, or has he failed to establish connection with the body? Undoubtedly, he has not yet established connection with the body, and this of itself would be equivalent to sleep, to unconsciousness. As a man born with none of the senses would be unconscious of himself, so framing him, just beginning to establish connections with his new body, is only dimly conscious of himself and sleeps. I fed him, or it, which is the proper designation will be decided in a few days, with the usual allowance.
May 17th, evening. I have been ill for the past 3 days and have not been out of doors until this morning. The Elasmosaurus was still motionless when I arrived at the cove this morning. Dead, I thought, but I soon detected signs of breathing, and I began to prepare some muscles for it and was intent upon my task when I heard a slight gasping sound and looked up. A feeling of terror seized me. It was as if in response to some doubting incantations. There had appeared the half-desired, yet wholly feared and unexpected apparition of a fiend. I shrieked, I screamed, and the amphitheater of rocks echoed and re-echoed my cries. And all the time, the head of the Elasmosaurus raised aloft to the full height of its neck, swayed about unsteadily, and its mouth silently struggled and twisted as if in an attempt to form words, while its eyes looked at me now with wild fear and now with piteous entreaty. "Framingham," I said. The monster's mouth closed instantly, and it looked at me attentively, pathetically so, as a dog might look. "Do you understand me?" The mouth began struggling again, and little gasps and moans issued forth. "If you understand me, lay your head on the rock." Down came the head. He understood me. My experiment was a success. I sat for a moment in silence, meditating upon the wonderful affair, striving to realize that I was awake and sane, and then began, in a calm manner, to relate to my friend what had taken place since his attempted suicide. "You are at present something in the condition of a partial paralytic, I should judge," said I, as I concluded my account. "Your mind has not yet learned to command your new body. I see you can move your head and neck, though with difficulty. Move your body if you can." "Ah, you cannot, as I thought. But it will come in time. Whether you'll be able to talk or not, I cannot say, but I think so, however. And now, if you cannot, we will arrange some means of communication. Anyhow, you are rid of your human body and possessed of the powerful vital apparatus you so much envied its former owner. When you gain control of yourself, I wish you to find the communication between this lake and the underworld and conduct some explorations. Just think of the additions to geological knowledge you can make. I will write an account of your discovery, and the names of Framingham and McLennigan will be among those of the greatest geologists." I waved my hands in my enthusiasm, and the great eyes of my friend glowed with a kindred fire.
June 2nd, night. The process by which Framingham has passed from his first powerlessness to his present ability to speak and command the use of his corporeal frame has been so gradual that there has been nothing to note down from day to day. He seems to have all the command over his vast bulk that its former owner had, and in addition, speaks and sings. He is singing now. The north wind has risen with the fall of night, and out there in the darkness, I hear the mighty organ pipe tones of his tremendous, magnificent voice, chanting the solemn notes of the Gregorian, the full-throated Latin words mingling with the roaring of the wind in a wild and weird harmony. Today, he attempted to find the connection between the lake and the interior of the earth, but the great well that sinks down in the center of the lake is choked with rocks, and he has discovered nothing. He is tormented by the fear that I will leave him, and that he will perish of loneliness. But I shall not leave him. I feel too much pity for the loneliness he would endure. And besides, I wish to be on the spot should another of those mysterious convulsions open the connection between the lake and the lower world. He is beset with the idea that should other men discover him, he may be captured and exhibited in a circus or museum, and declares that he will fight for his liberty, even to the extent of taking the lives of those attempting to capture him. As a wild animal, he is the property of whomsoever captures him, though perhaps I can set up a title to him on the ground of having tamed him.
July 6th. One of Framingham's fears has been realized. I was at the pass leading into the basin, watching the clouds grow heavy and pendulous, when I saw a net appear over a knoll in the pass, followed by its bearer, a small man, unmistakably a scientist. But I did not note him well, for as he looked down into the valley, suddenly there burst forth with all the power and volume of a steam calliope the tremendous voice of Framingham, singing a Greek song of Anacreon to the tune of "Where Did You Get That Hat?"
and the singer appeared in a little cove, the black column of his great neck raised aloft, his jagged jaws wide open. That poor little scientist. He stood transfixed, his butterfly net dropped from his hand, and as Framingham ceased his singing, curvetted and leapt from the water and came down with a splash that set the whole cove swashing and laughed a guffaw that echoed through the cliffs like the laughing of a dozen demons, he turned and sped through the pass at all speed. I skip all entries for nearly a year. They are unimportant. June 30th, 1897. A change is certainly coming over my friend. I began to see it some time ago, but refused to believe it and set it down to imagination. A catastrophe threatens, the absorption of the human intellect by the brute body. There are precedents for believing it possible. The human body has more influence over the mind than the mind has over the body. The invalid, delicate Framingham with refined mind is no more. In his stead is a roistering monster, whose boisterous and commonplace conversation betrays a constantly growing coarseness of mind. No longer is he interested in my scientific investigations, but pronounces them all bosh. No longer is his conversation such as an educated man can enjoy, but slangy and diffuse iterations concerning the trivial happenings of our uneventful life. Where will it end? In the absorption of the human mind by the brute body? In the final triumph of matter over mind and the degradation of the most mundane force and the extinction of the celestial spark? Then indeed will Edward Framingham be dead, and over the grave of his human body can I fittingly erect a headstone. And then will my vigil in this valley be over.
Fort D.A. Russell, Wyoming, April 15, 1899. Professor William G. Breyfogle. Dear Sir, the enclosed intact manuscript and the fragments which accompany it came into my possession in the manner I am about to relate, and I enclose them to you, for whom they were intended by their late author. 2 weeks ago, I was dispatched into the mountains after some Indians who had left their reservation, having under my command a company of infantry and 2 squads of cavalrymen with mountain howitzers. On the 7th day of our pursuit, which led us into a wild and unknown part of the mountains, we were startled at hearing from somewhere in front of us a succession of bellowings of a very unusual nature, mingled with the cries of a human being apparently in the last extremity. And rushing over a rise before us, we looked down upon a lake and saw a colossal, indescribable thing engaged in rending the body of a man. Observing us, it stretched its jaws and laughed, and in saying this, I wished to be taken literally. Part of my command cried out that it was the devil and turned and ran, but I rallied them, and thoroughly enraged at what we had witnessed, we marched down to the shore, and I ordered the howitzers to be trained upon the murderous creature. While we were doing this, the thing kept up a constant blabbing that bore a distinct resemblance to human speech, sounding very much like the jabbering of an imbecile or a drunk trying to talk. I gave the command to fire and to fire again, and the beast tore out into the lake in its death agony and sank. With the remains of Dr. McLennigan, I found the foregoing manuscript intact and the torn fragments of the diary from which it was compiled, together with other papers on scientific subjects, all of which I forward. I think some attempt should be made to secure the body of the Elasmosaurus. It would be a priceless addition to any museum. Arthur W. Fairchild, Captain, USA. You've been listening to The Monster of Lake Lemaitre by Warden Alan Curtis. Warden Alan Curtis was a journalist and short story author in the late 1800s and early 1900s. The Monster of Lake Lemaitre is his most well-known work. He died in 1940. Next, here's The Day of the Dragon by Guy Endor. No, in those days, no one ever thought of such a peril to the existence of the human race. I was young then, but I recall the times distinctly.
Scientists at their annual meetings used to discuss the probability of the termination of the triumphant progress of the human race. But that it should come about in this fashion, this terrible and at the same time ridiculous fashion, that no one ever imagined. At the present writing, it does seem that the complete extinction of all mankind will be delayed, for there must be quite a number of small communities that have found refuge in mines and caves. And though it is long since we've had any word from them, yet in big cities such as Paris, Berlin, and London, where there are impregnable subway systems, men and women can still hold out against the terror that ravages the open country. But how long can we last? Few people, I suppose, are more capable than I of recapitulating the whole story from its completely insane inception, of which I believe I was and remain the only living witness. I've heard lately so many different versions of how it all began that I want to say this. They are, for the most part, far from the truth. But it's a very human necessity to demand an explanation of some sort. Well, as I say, in those days, scientists used to imagine many perils to mankind. Some foresaw vast cataclysms, others predicted more subtle scourges. Very frequent was the prophecy that insects would succeed to the rule of the earth. I can still recall clearly a very stirring lecture delivered by a great entomologist. He began by pointing out that though new species of insects were being discovered at a rate of 10,000 a year, and over 500,000 kinds were already listed, yet by virtue of the processes of evolution, he felt that the insects were increasing their species at a faster rate than they were being cataloged, certainly faster than their widely varying habits were capable of being studied. So that, in short, as far as insects were concerned, science was playing a losing hand. He pictured vividly the hordes of insects that attacked our food crops in those days, the blights, the scales, the weevils, the fruit flies, and moths of all kinds. The listeners shivered as they heard tales of vast clouds of grasshoppers leaving whole countries bare, all growing things nibbled down to the last stalk, tales of permanent battle lines of the entrenched farmer, the gardener, the orchard grower, fighting off with poisonous gases the perpetually renewed attacks of their inexhaustible insect enemies. What, the lecturer queried, might happen in a moment of inattention? What if, by mischance, some natural enemy of a given insect were to cease its alliance with man and allow this insect to breed in such multitudes as to ruin crops all over the world? Imagine, the lecturer told us, months of famine during which whole races would perish and others lapse into savagery and cannibalism. Was that to be the end of our proud civilization? Our puny chemicals would soon be found ineffective against these armored beasts, whose small size and vast numbers are so much in their favor. But, so this lecturer affirmed, the peril from such disorganized swarms is small compared to that offered by those practically civilized insects, the ants, whose numerous varieties are already so high on the rungs of the ladder of progress. The ant cultivates plants, keeps domestic animals, has masons and bridge builders, lawmakers and rulers, soldiers and captains. What if some Napoleon of the ant world were to rise and were to ally all the many species of ants into a great confederacy, the object of which would be the subjugation of the earth? What if ant scientists were to discover some glandular extract that would cause them to grow to enormous size? Have not bees and many other insects already developed something analogous? What is to prevent them from doing this, then waxing big as rats, to move against mankind in order to enslave and domesticate it? What a comic tragedy. Man ending his history in the stalls of vast pyramidal anthills, the ant's bondservant, his domestic animal. Curious, now I think of it, how man has come to a pass that is nearly, if not quite as, ridiculous. I must say this lecturer had a pretty clear idea of what would happen, but how it was to come about, that was another matter. He had his guess, to which he was entitled. The guesses of others took different directions. I shan't dwell upon them at length. Now it was the sun that was to become exhausted, whereupon our planet would grow cold, the vast seas frozen to the very bottom, and all life refrigerated to death in perfect cold storage embalming. Again, it was the earth that was to cease to revolve, leaving one half of itself parched in perpetual high noon sunshine, the other frozen in eternal midnight. Or else it was a comet that was to strike our earth and shatter it into a million inconsequential planetoids. To such cataclysmic horrors, others opposed more subtle dangers. Did not the statistics of insanity show that its rate of increase was such that it would not be long before the whole world was a raving madhouse, in which such poor normal beings as might remain would have a far from enviable fate? Would not, so other students asked, the increasing use of fuel disturb the balance of the atmosphere? Would not the use of oil by motor ships give rise to a scum of oil on the seas? In short, were we not about to blanket the earth and the waters and shut out the health-giving ultraviolet rays without which life is impossible? But that we should be attacked and destroyed by a legendary animal. No, that I never heard from the mouth of any of these scientists. Why, such an animal does not even exist, they would have said. Ridiculous! A fabulous monster! Why, that's pure myth! Oh, good enough, I suppose, for fairy tale writers and for artists with lively fancies. But we serious... Well, it was out of just such legends that it came about. That sounds strange and impossible, but it's true. Listen. In the old days, in the golden era, when mankind walked out carefree into the great light, where the laughing sun played on the pied fields and the good breeze blew. I was then a reporter, and I well remember the time I was called upon to do a story on a live toad said to have been immured for a billion years in rock. That was the beginning of it. In some upstate county, this toad hopped out of a kind of natural bubble in the stone, hopped out just as the stonecutter's chisel broke through into the air hole. And the workman, flabbergasted, ran to the editor of the village paper and there gasped out his tale. A local amateur geologist claimed that the rock of this region had been laid down a billion years or more ago, and that the toad must, therefore, be a billion years old or more. But the editor of the paper called the stonecutter a fool for not having caught the toad. A group of people, however, who had gone out to investigate, found a toad not 10 feet away from the cup-like depression, the stone bubble, and there was no reason to think that this was any other but the long-lived toad, just out from a billion years of solitary confinement. The story, though old and often scorned, got about. The toad was exhibited in the village drugstore, where he contentedly accepted a tribute of live flies, and a reporter from a nearby town called to write up the tale and take pictures of the toad and the quarrymen. And so, the story came to New York. The Sunday Rotogravure ran pictures of the event, and such was the interest stirred up that I was asked to collect opinions from the wiseacres of the museum and the local colleges and scientific institutes. Naturally, I took advantage of this assignment to look up my old teacher, Crabshaw. We used to call him Fossil Crab's Paw. If you said it rapidly, it sounded so much like Professor Crabshaw that we dared to say it to his face. And being young and silly, we thought it a very brave and clever thing to do. I thought it would be good fun to see old Crabshaw again. But it did not prove to be such fun, for the once so familiar biologic laboratory on the top floor made me melancholy, and the memory of many drowsy afternoons spent here dissecting cockroaches and rats afflicted me. The dissecting room was empty, but there in the rear was old Professor Crabshaw's office. I could see him sitting at his desk, bent over a pile of examination papers. He was more seedy than ever, and I swear he wore the same old acid-stained smock, even as his meek face bore the same old pale and drooping whiskers. The honors and awards of being a scientist had passed over Professor Crabshaw and left him practically where he had started. He was still an instructor, overworked and poor, and yet he had done some fair work. He used to tell, with considerable pride, how his work on the surface tension of various fluids taken from protozoa of different types had suggested to him the possibility of constructing a synthetic cell. This suggestion had been taken up by a later worker and carried to success, reaping fame and rich material rewards. but not for Crabshaw. I introduced myself to the professor and reminded him that I had once been a student in his class. He smiled and bade me be seated. That he was pleased to have a great newspaper ask him for his opinion was evident.
Of course, there's no truth in it. Just another popular fallacy like horsehair snakes. The toad, no doubt, lived nearby. You say yourself that it differs not at all from the present species common to that region. That explains the whole story, which after all relies almost entirely on the say-so of the quarryman, who was probably frightened out of his wits when a toad hopped past his chisel.
May I quote you? I asked. It was in his answer to this that Professor Crabshaw revealed all the meekness of his nature. All the years in which the better diplomats in his science had advanced to more important posts, while he, the patient worker, had remained behind to correct examination papers.
I'm afraid I can't permit that. You may say, that a professor at a local college, a well-known biologist of note, well, any sort of paraphrase.
He smiled, pleased at his own flattery of himself, and content to visualize himself praised, even anonymously. As I left, I imagined him secretly hoping I might forget his injunction and publish his name. But we published nothing, for it was decided to have a feature article on the subject in the Sunday magazine section. When the editor of the Sunday magazine told me this, I suggested Professor Crabshaw as a likely person to do the article. The moment I did so, I regretted it. No one could have been more unsuited to the task, but I consoled myself with the thought that he would surely refuse to write for a cheap paper. But I was mistaken. He accepted, so I learned, and with great pleasure. Had he been seduced by the need of the $200, which was the magazine's price for the article? I confess I was rather worried, for I felt myself responsible for the whole business. I therefore called him up on the telephone and began by explaining that it was I who had recommended him.
I thought as much, he replied. And you must have lunch with me. Can you meet me at the faculty club at once?
I accepted, thinking that my business would be settled better across a table. Professor Crabshaw was prompt to the appointment. With him was his wife, a buxom, frowsy person whose not unkindly face showed plainly the effects of years of disappointed hopes. She was voluble in her thanks to me. It was so kind of me to have recommended Paul. That it was the $200 that magnetized her was easy to guess. Her conversation at the luncheon was of nothing but money.
Look, she said, there's Professor Slocum. Of course you've heard of him, economics, you know. They say he's made a fortune in Wall Street. Those economists have secrets. You should see his new roadster. And that's Professor Dillinger, yes, the man with the little beard. He's rich. That's his wife there, the tall one with the permanent. He's got political connections. They say he's the brains for the sugar lobby.
Now, Lizzie, Crabshaw objected.
But it's true. Just take a look at Professor Wilson. Just because he discovered that the mob reacts like a spoiled baby, he got himself a $100,000-a-year job with an advertising house. Oh, Paul, why haven't you ever discovered something brilliant like that? But of course, what can one do with protozoa? I always say there's no profit to be made out of raising such tiny bits of things.
Well, I did once discover, Crabshaw began meekly.
Yes, Paul, we know all about that, his wife said severely.
But, Lizzie, I was only going to explain to Mr.
Paul, how often must I tell you to call me Elspeth? You know, she said, turning to me, that I've always felt that if Paul would only get used to calling me Elspeth instead of Lizzie, he'd make at least $1,000 more a year.
I saw that this conversation was becoming very painful to Crabshaw, so I began to question him about the article. What have you planned to say?
Well, I've begun with an examination of the much-disputed topic of what constitutes scientific evidence. Then, taking up the story of the toad, I show that the proper evidence is lacking. And I conclude with a discussion of the life habits of the toad and the experiments that have been made on prolonging the hibernation of various animals, demonstrating that they cannot survive much beyond their usual period.
This was, of course, precisely what I had been afraid of. A rather dull, scientific, educational tract.
That's fine, I said.
But I'm just a little afraid it may not appeal to the reading public of our paper. Now, if you're seriously thinking of writing this sort of article, you'll need to come down a bit. Meet the public halfway. Its interest would be more aroused by a toad that had actually lived 1 billion years. Give the toad a chance to do his stuff.
But toads don't live 1 billion years, Crabshaw exclaimed. It's preposterous.
That's it, I cried. That's precisely it. The more preposterous, the better. You are a scientist, and you can give the preposterous that scientific veneer that will make it acceptable.
But,
objected Crabshaw, his jaw hanging. His wife cut him short.
Of course you can't, Paul. Think of it. $200 every time you write an article. Why, that's almost a month's salary.
Even more than that, Mrs. Crabshaw, I said, if the articles should ever come into demand and editors compete for your husband's product. Professor Crabshaw looked most woebegone, but we two had no pity on him. I saw that in gaining an ally in Mrs. Crabshaw, I had the matter clinched and induced. The article turned out to be all that could be expected of the most experienced yellow journalist. We ran it under big headlines: Great Scientist Champions Billion-Year-Old Toad, by Professor Paul Crabshaw, internationally famous biologist. And we had enormous pictures of toads along with a strip of vignettes showing Our Artist's Conception of History and the Toad, in which, above repeated pictures of the toad immured in his rock prison, were depicted prehistoric animals, the glacial period, early ape-like man, first signs of civilization in Egypt, then the Jews captive in Babylon, then Christ on the cross, and following that, Columbus and his caravel, Napoleon, and then the final picture typifying the most up-to-date scene, the President of the United States surrounded by a draped flag and a spread eagle. In the article itself, Professor Crabshaw adduced numerous reasons, all couched in the form of striking anecdotes and designed to prove the possibility of a billion-year-old toad. It really made great yellow journalism, but it made mighty poor science for a college professor, and the higher powers were down upon him at once. But that meant nothing to the editor of the Sunday magazine. A few weeks later, when passengers came home with the tale of having sighted a sea serpent, that hoary legend was sent to Professor Paul Crabshaw for confirmation. And again he made good, no doubt goaded by Lizzie. In a short time, the articles of Crabshaw had become indispensable and were a regular feature for which we paid increasing prices. There followed articles on boys brought up by wolves, living in the forest and running on all fours, and articles on the plagues of Egypt and, well, that sort of thing. For several years this continued, during which Lizzie sure enough blossomed into Elspeth, with facials, permanence, and better clothes to make her look the part. I used to meet them now and then for lunch at the faculty club, where Professor Crabshaw, at his wife's behest, still went, though he could feel that his colleagues had lost their respect for him.
"But I'm preparing my revenge," he confided to me one day. "I'm going to electrify the world. You just watch and see. I'm going to prove that marvelous things can and do happen, and that will be my vindication for that tripe on 'Was Jonah swallowed by a whale?' and 'What will man look like 50,000 years from now?"
"Tell me more," I begged. He shook his head, and Elspeth said, "He won't even show me what he's doing, but he's got himself a laboratory or something off in New Jersey, and he goes there every day now." One morning, Crabshaw called me up and insisted that I must come up to see him at once, that he had something quite marvelous to show me. There was a note of exultation in his voice that made me drop my work and obey him. When I arrived, he wrung my hand in his thin, nervous fingers. Then, skipping ahead of me like a French dancing master, he led me into his study.
"Now," he said when I was seated, "my great day is at hand." And with a smile that freed and relaxed all the long frozen wrinkles of his face, he declared proudly, "I was fired last night."
Seeing my look of astonishment, he continued,
"No, not fired precisely, but given an ultimatum in something of this manner."
Then old Crabshaw pulled in his little chin, tried to look cocky and arrogant and paunchy, and said,
"Here stood Prexy, just like this. He said, 'Mr. Crabshaw,'
You see, it was no longer Professor, but just Mister. Mr. Crabshaw, I think the moment has come for you to decide what subject you are most interested in, science or fiction writing. I answered him back hotly. Mr. President, you have no right to set a limit to scientific investigation. And he answered, No, but we try to keep our departments of science and belles-lettres distinct. Then I said, Mr. President, if you want to be shown that I'm not romancing, but have made one of the greatest contributions ever made to biology, I invite you over to my New Jersey laboratory tomorrow. You'll see mythology come to life. I've invited several of my skeptical colleagues to come with me, and if you wish to be fair to me, I shall have the honor of calling for you at 3 tomorrow. He refused at first, but upon my insistence that I deserved a fair trial, he consented. It is past 2 now, and we must leave soon. You will go along as a member of the press, and you will write this up for your paper. So get out your pencil and make notes of what I'm going to tell you. This will be the biggest scoop of your life, and will serve to repay you some for what you did for me. But I began. Let's not argue now, he said hastily. We haven't the time. Listen carefully. I was going to make an article of this myself, but on second thought, I decided that the first report ought to come from someone else. I would never be credited by serious readers, for it's more fantastic than anything I've ever written, and yet every word of it is true. Let me begin at the beginning, however. You knew, did you not, that for some time I've been suffering under the slights of my fellow scientists. I confess, I did write many silly articles, but if science would not butter my bread, then I had to do something else. So for a long time, I've been scheming to rehabilitate myself. At first, all I could do was hope and pray that something might happen that would, of itself, lift this reproach from me, some striking event that would, so to speak, give a little basis for my flights of fancy. Then I began to cudgel my brains to scheme out something of my own. After several false attempts that I need not discuss here, I recalled something I'd known for many years, and I wondered if there might not be a possibility for me in this bit of knowledge. Perhaps you can still recall from my classroom lectures the nature of the reptilian heart. Well, in brief, it is, compared to the mammalian heart, the human heart, for example, an incomplete organ. In a way, it's a malformation, for it's so constructed that the blood vessels of the animal are never filled with freshly oxygenated blood. The old stale blood, replete with body poisons, mixes in the chambers of the heart with the bright, clean blood from the lungs and is pumped back through the body again, only half cleansed. Scientifically, we express that by saying that the septum between the ventricles, the wall that should be there to keep the two bloodstreams separated, is incompletely formed. The animal thus suffers all its lifetime from auto-intoxication and is by nature sluggish. Suffers is perhaps the wrong word, for its whole organism is evidently attuned to this subnormal state. The alligator is then, to speak roughly, a lifelong congenital cardiac, incapable of great activity except in infrequent spasms. His race is an invalid race, each member born an invalid and remaining an invalid throughout its existence. And does not the alligator give us an example of how the cardiac should live? No physician could prescribe anything finer for his patients than the alligator's calm, docile, peaceful, snoozy sort of life. Notice the alligators at the aquarium. They may look fierce, but they are condemned invalids, and no matter how long they live, they will continue to practice extreme caution, sparing their poor circulatory systems, lying all day in bed, that is to say, in the warm mud, and doing very little more than sending out an occasional blink of the eyelid. Well, Crabshaw went on before I could interrupt. It occurred to me one day to see what would happen if that bad heart condition of the alligator were cleared up, or at least improved by stretching that incomplete septum to form a dividing wall between the venous and the arterial bloodstreams. I immediately procured a lot of baby alligators and set to work to find out. My method was simple. I just chloroformed my patient and operated on him, following, as well as I could, the directions given in a textbook on surgery. My mortality rate was enormous.
No doubt my surgical technique was atrocious, but then I'm no surgeon and don't pretend to be one. It seemed that the heart condition only grew worse after the incomplete septum was stretched out. The poor alligators just turned up their pale and swollen bellies and gave up their alligatorish ghosts. Many of them did not even bother to recover from the effects of the chloroform. I, myself, was frequently on the point of throwing up the sponge when patient number 87 gave me the courage to carry on. For several hours after the operation, that fellow ran about the room like a frisky puppy. I'm sure that no one in the world has ever witnessed such speed and agility on the part of an alligator. I tell you, he ran about like a chipmunk, dived in and out of the water tank, leapt, frolicked, and dashed about in a reckless, gleeful manner that was a marvel and a delight to behold. Then suddenly, over he turned, wriggled his paws madly like a toy train upset, the wheels of which continue to spin until the spring is unwound. Number 87 revived my courage. I determined to fight on, and as I say, I gradually grew more skillful and altered my technique by constant improvement as I studied the matter. Finally, I determined to try somewhat larger specimens than those I had hitherto been working on, and do more thorough and careful operations. Out of 10 trials, I achieved 2 amazing successes, whereupon I ceased to operate on further specimens and studied those 2. I noted, in the first place, that they devoured from 4 to 8 times as much food as ordinary alligators of their age. But then they were never still for a moment, whereas their ailing brothers slept most of the day. Indeed, my 2 alligators grew so fast that I realized that something had to be done quickly, or they would soon outgrow my little laboratory. At that time, I worked in a store I had rented, a former seafood shop, in which the leftover equipment provided me with excellent facilities for the performance of my experiments. I say, it behooved me now to hasten, lest I be caught in a jam, for at their rate of growth, I realized that I would soon be unable to move them. Fortunately, I was able to locate and rent, for a reasonable price, a former platinum refinery in New Jersey, a large, single-story brick building, a shed, rather, which was particularly suited to my purposes since the windows were all heavily barred with iron. I had some trouble crating and moving my pets. I had to creep up on the beasts and spray them with chloroform, and that was a dangerous business, for I very nearly chloroformed myself. I should have had help, but I wanted no inkling of my work to reach the outside world. And those alligators were quick as birds, and big, too, as large, I should say, as young calves. They had grown to 4 times their original size in 6 days' time. And could they fight and squirm? Well, anyway, that's all over, and I now have my 2 pretty ones in their new home, which was at that time comfortably arranged to house them. Yes, I say pretty ones, for they were sleek and shiny, and the way they flirted their tails and skimmed along the floor with their paws moving so fast you could hardly see them was a pleasure, and their eyes were never closed. I had built a big tank for them, and you should have seen them swim and dive and go leaping out of the water and come falling back with loud smacking splashes, like dolphins or seals, and taking such joy in life. I wish I could show you that, but they've outgrown that tank now. I must build them a new one. I tell you, I used to watch them by the hour and say to myself, "You're a public benefactor, you are. Here are the first 2 healthy alligators in the world. Why has man been so cruel as to reserve his medical knowledge so much for himself and his domestic animals? Wildlife, too, needs some attention." You see, I hadn't then an inkling of what I had really succeeded in doing, but I was right, nevertheless, in one respect. I had given health to 2 alligators, and I was the first privileged human being to observe what a healthy alligator was like. I noticed many peculiarities that set off my healthy 2 from the rest of the sickly breed of alligators. They began, for example, to show a better growth in the chest. They swelled out something like geckos. You know how geckos look, those small lizards. And with a better growth of the chest cavity went a different carriage of the head. The head rose from the ground, from which the ordinary alligator does not seem to have the strength to raise it, and was held up a bit, thus contriving to give the beasts the appearance of a neck. That bad posture that one notices in all alligators, crocodiles, and gavials, and related species, is plainly just another symptom of their congenital heart trouble. They are all stricken down with severe auto-intoxication. It is to be noticed, by the way, that they all have a bad breath. My alligators had a sweet breath. The next noteworthy change in outward appearance was the heavier growth of those spinal processes. In fact, in the common diseased alligator, there are no spinal processes to speak of, though along the tail are to be found some heavy skin growths forming a serrated ridge, and indicating perhaps what nature intended the beast to have there, and which is actually to be seen on my two specimens, namely, ridges that are part of the spine and that reach luxurious proportions. The tail, too, grew larger and longer each day, and there's nothing prettier to see than the way it curls and rolls in rich serpentine curves and even in complete circles. You won't be able to see that now because the quarters have become so cramped, but you will see how instead of terminating in a weak point, my healthy alligators have developed a flat arrowhead on the end, something like a whale's tail, only sharper. Mind you, those beasts of mine were now consuming each a good-sized sheep, and demanding more every day. And though big around as cows, and, of course, two or three times as long, they were still but tots, so to speak, being but a few months old and still in the process of development. Especially curious was the ridge that grew along the back, and which, between the shoulder blades and the hips, I, if I may be permitted such loose anatomical designations, seemed to rise higher each day and to have greater internal structural support, for not only did the spine enter into its formation, but the ribs actually grew out of the body and provided buttresses for it. For some weeks, my patients appeared as if a heavy mushroom-like parasol were sprouting out of their backs. Now, whatever can that be? I used to wonder and continued to watch. But there were so many interesting things to see. I must explain that with my beasts the size of elephants, I ceased to be able to examine them very closely. I'll tell you the way I go about it. The factory is along a rarely used unsurfaced road in a remote part of the country, and I drive up there every day, formerly in an old used car, but now in a truck specially purchased, and loaded down with a couple of sheep or pigs fresh from the slaughterhouse and with several tubs of fish. Before I installed a differential pulley, I had to drag all this up to the roof and dump the whole business through a ventilator on it. I don't dare enter the place. Why, it was even dangerous to do that much, for their lashing tails with that heavy and sharp arrowhead termination used to come whipping about and crash through the glass of the window, or rather, whatever fragments of glass remained in the window, and come out thumping and feeling around on the roof. I guess they were curious to find out what was all the disturbance up there. Or perhaps they knew it was feeding time and they just wanted to show their appreciation of my solicitude. I often did think they felt gratitude for me, their deliverer from the oppression of heart trouble. Oh yes, I forgot to tell you how they began to show knobs on their snouts, and how these knobs kept growing out and formed what I can only describe as feelers or whiskers, heavy things, flexible and curling like the trunk of an elephant, only thinner and covered with a leathery integument. Well, one of those feelers came whipping out of the ventilator one day and gave me a caress that tore through all my clothes and left a deep, bloody scar. As I say, I suppose it was a caress, but I was so frightened that I jerked back. I believed that if it had been ill-meant, I wouldn't be here to tell about it. Yes, I'm pretty nearly positive of the fact that they like me. Of late, it has grown more and more difficult to get a good glimpse of them. It's been getting more and more dangerous to go near that building, and before I rigged up my rope system, I used to climb up to the roof by a ladder placed against the rear of the building where there aren't any windows. And once on the roof, I'd make sure that nothing was protruding from the ventilator, and then I'd rush up and cast down my load and rush right back with another load. Once they were busy eating, it was fairly safe. Now and then, I'd put my eye to a little opening I'd found and peer through.
There were my beasts, growing larger every day, greater now than elephants in the bulk of their torso, and with that parasol-like growth on their backs expanding and expanding, and shaping itself into two vast ovals, one on each side. Then, one day, it came over me suddenly what these were. Wings. Yes, sir. Wings. And suddenly, too, that day I realized what I possessed there, locked up in that old factory, and I ran back to my car and drove at breakneck speed to New York and to the library. Why, of course, what else but dragons? And the stories and pictures of those fabulous beasts proved to me that my alligators were not the only healthy alligators that had ever existed. There had been, at various times, but mostly in prehistoric days, other rare specimens of healthy alligators. How else explain the fact that people had seen precisely such monsters as I have out there and preserved the record of their appearance and story and art? Why, those Chinese dragons you see embroidered in silk were as like mine as two peas. Undoubtedly, there appears now and then, but exceedingly rarely, a sport or variant among the alligators or crocodiles, provided by chance with a healthy heart, and so free from auto-intoxication. But to get back to the progress of my pets, they continued to develop, and pretty soon I began to see their wings unfold, with those enormous ribs of theirs strengthening them like ribbed Gothic vaulting. Hunched they are at the shoulders, and then smoothing down flat to the rear and wrapping against the lower body like enormous shields. You can see that they're aching now to try out the wings, but there's no room in the factory. But now and then they do a little tentative flapping, you know, like chickens, and then they subside sadly. I tell you, it breaks my heart to see them so confined. But that will be remedied. Now they have begun to look awkward on the ground, trailing their immense wings, their size preventing them from frisking around as they used to do. They move back and forth like caged beasts, and I can see that their tempers are getting short and ugly.
He paused suddenly and looked at his watch.
Come, we've no time to waste. I'm to call for the delegation at 2:45 and then be at the president's house at 3 sharp.
Say, I exclaimed, this is all so terribly exciting that my head is simply whirling. What a story this is going to make. We'll run a whole page of pictures.
I was so carried away by Crabshaw's vivid story that I never for a moment doubted its veracity.
Pictures? Crabshaw cried. Pictures, of course. Why did I never think of that? But I've been so feverishly excited. We must take some now. Wait, let me get our camera. I wish I had kept a photographic record of their development. Well, that will have to wait for the next group I operate on.
I suggested calling up for one of our news photographers, but he vetoed the idea. For the present, he wanted no outsider except me. We drove out in a limousine Crabshaw had hired for the occasion. There was a curious, strained atmosphere among the occupants of the car. At first, there had been solemn politeness, the stilted courtesy of duelists, which now and then one of the former colleagues of Crabshaw would try to break by a weak attempt at humor. Crabshaw brushed these attempts aside and set the conversation on the recent spell of hot weather or the latest political news, and in that fashion the conversation limped along until we had driven far out into New Jersey and had gone off the traveled highway and were bumping along a forest road much in need of repair. The professors sat with their hats on their knees, the president wiped the copious sweat from his brow, and Crabshaw, thin and alert, kept leaning forward to give the driver directions. Suddenly, Crabshaw gave a cry. The car drove out into an open space and stopped abruptly. Before us were the heaped ruins of what had once been a red brick building of some size. Disregarding our solicitous inquiries, Crabshaw continued to yell,
"They've escaped! They've broken out! They're gone!"
We could not get any other intelligent statement from him. He ran out and scrambled up over the masses of wreckage, the heaps of brick, the twisted girders, and continued to let forth one piercing scream after another. We sat in the car for a while, overcome by a powerful stench that, along with the heat of the day, robbed our lungs of the breath they craved. The president, holding his kerchief to his nose, a gesture that his professional satellites imitated at once,
made a muffled nasal remark. Our friend has histrionic talents, too.
Phew. If you agree with me, gentlemen, that we've seen enough, let us be off. I can't breathe here.
Nor I,
said the obedient professors. But I followed Crabshaw up the heap of wreckage and looked down upon the interior of the building, where vast mounds of trampled filth lay so thick that it almost obscured the existence of a flat concrete floor beneath, and the odor was like that of the monkey house at the zoo, only many times worse.
The president cried out, "Crabshaw, I insist upon being driven back to my residence at once. Otherwise, I shall commandeer this car and leave you here."
Crabshaw, his eyes popping out of his head, his voice cracked with sobs, shouted back,
"Come on up here, you fools! There's evidence left here, at any rate. Look at these footprints!"
Two of the professors, more curious and bolder than the rest, mounted to where we stood and looked down upon the scene below. But they only had eyes for the filth and not for its meaning or origin.
"The Augean stables had nothing on this," one of them began. "See those prints?" Crabshaw cried.
"I insist, Crabshaw!"
bellowed the president, whereupon one of the professors dutifully declared,
"I've seen enough,"
and the other echoed that flat statement. It made no difference to them how Crabshaw swore and begged and whined, with the tears flying from his eyes, his mouth sputtering.
"Here, you, Professor Albert, world-famous paleontologist. Why don't you measure these footprints? What animal do they come from? Did you ever see such enormous holes as these claws have dug? And you, Professor Wiener, why do you stand like dummies? Do you turn up your noses because the evidence is not a million years old? Why, if this were in the rocks of Montana, you'd be all over the ground, sniffing and measuring and preparing to write huge tomes. What's the matter with you now?"
Gently, I led the hysterical man down from his mound of bricks and pulled him into the car. On the drive home, he remained silent, except for an occasional attempt to arouse the others with a sarcastic or pleading remark. To these, the president answered once, without looking at poor Crabshaw.
"I have never been so hoodwinked before, so grossly insulted."
And the scientists repeated, "A plain fraud." "Assaulted mine," said another, and one mentioned Cessnola and the fake antiquities he palmed off on the Metropolitan Museum, and another mentioned Glozel, and a third thought of the Louvre and the crown of Artifernes, and then they reminded themselves of the Cardiff Giant. In short, they passed in sarcastic review all the trickeries ever perpetuated upon science. But all things have an end. Eventually, we unloaded our cargo of scoffers and proceeded on to Crabshaw's apartment. The life had gone out of the man so that I could not desert him, but must see him safely home. As we rode on to his apartment, I heard newsboys crying extras. Though the moment was hardly propitious, I felt that my profession demanded a copy. I stopped the car and called to one of the boys. No sooner had I spread out the sheet than I gave Crabshaw a mighty slap on the shoulder, for I confess that my first emotion was one of exultation. "Look, man, read this," I cried. "Monsters attack Atlantic City. Four bathing beauties among missing. Many spectators at bathing beauty contest are slain, and many maimed by flying monsters." As usual, the actual news report was meager, for extras often have nothing more than a headline to sell. It's published while the reporters hustle out to secure more complete information. The body of the article repeated, in various forms, the following story. Conflicting reports by telephone from Atlantic City tell of enormous flying monsters, birds, or airplanes. Eyewitnesses are not in agreement on this point. Attacking the crowd assembled to watch the final awards in the nationwide competition for the nomination of Miss America. Two or more scarlet birds of vast size swooped down on the panic-stricken multitude, who dashed for cover in all directions. One informant declares he was reminded of the airplane attacks on infantry that were a feature of the World War. Whatever they were, beast or machine, they mutilated dozens of bystanders and were gone. Their appearance and disappearance were so rapid, their speed was so enormous, that no one seems to have retained a clear notion as to precisely what happened. The monsters seem to have swooped down out of the clouds and back again, carrying off some of their victims and leaving the boardwalk strewn with the dead and the dying. The earliest reports from the hastily organized volunteer ambulance and medical corps, and so on. I grew more and more serious as I read of the victims, but Crabshaw only expanded. He slapped his knee.
"Ha ha! Those healthy youngsters! What an appetite! Think of that! Just swooped down from the clouds!"
He illustrated the maneuver with a swoop of his hand.
"Snatched up those beauties and climbed right back out of human sight! Wow! Think of it, man!"
And he gave me a jovial dig in the ribs. "I'm thinking of it, all right," I said soberly. But he was so delighted that he actually began to caper around in the car. It was droll, but I could not laugh. I thought of the dead and dying out there on the boardwalk, and the four young girls who had come to exhibit their youth and beauty, and who had been snatched up beyond the clouds and devoured.
"Stop! Stop the car!"
Crabshaw shouted.
"We must get dozens of those papers and clip out those articles and send them to those benighted professional asses who came out there and refused to use their five senses."
"Do nothing of the kind," I cried and pulled Crabshaw back to his seat. "Listen to me, you fool. Do you want the whole world on your neck? Don't you realize what your dragons have done? They've killed or injured for life scores of people. What will the world say of Professor Crabshaw when it learns that his petty desire for vindication in the eyes of his colleagues has caused wholesale murder? Take my advice and keep quiet about this, and pray that it may blow over. Or enjoy your bloody triumph if you like, but beware of proclaiming it. As far as I'm concerned, not a word of your connection with this gruesome business in Atlantic City will get into the newspapers." That sobered him, but only for a moment. Then he wagged his head, tickled silly by the accomplishment of his pets.
"Husky youngsters," he muttered over and over again to himself.
Then he exclaimed out loud,
"Husky youngsters! God, what will they do when they're full grown? Can you imagine? Why, they're only kids now. They're not a year old yet, and just out of the hospital, so to speak. Why, come to think of it, this is the first day they flew. Say, what do you suppose they'll do when they're as big as battleships? Bigger, maybe. Wow."
And he went on, ruminating gleefully.
"Flying so perfectly on their first essay. Where's the human aviator who could equal that? And say, by gosh, I never thought of that. Do you recall all the stories of the dragons demanding a tribute of fair maidens? Well, there you see it. First thing they do is go after the beautiful virgins. Just another proof for you that those old artists and poets were not just imbeciles, but as good scientific observers as any of us moderns. Fairy tales, eh? I tell you, Mr. President, those fairy tales are true, and Crabshaw's fancies are as good as any of your old stodgy facts. Maybe better, because dreams come true, while facts are always being challenged and disproved."
He went on thus while the car drove to his home. Just as we reached there, he let out a scream that nearly stopped my heart beating.
"What's the matter now?" I gasped. "Never thought of it," he shouted. "Never once occurred to me. Oh, this is rich, just too perfect. Male and female created he them. Yes, sir, one male and one female. Think of it, man. Think of the race that will come from these beasts. Why, it—"
He stood there with an ecstatic smile on his uplifted face. It was as if he felt himself akin to the Creator and was calling down a blessing upon the Adam and Eve of a new race of dragons. It occurred to me later where I had heard people talk just like Crabshaw during that ride home. Parents, hard-working parents of the poorer classes, who raise up their children to take the place in the world that they, the parents, would have liked to occupy. They speak thus. And for Crabshaw, his dragons, so strong, so unassailable, were his sons who were going to wipe out with their strength all the disappointments that he had been forced to swallow. No sooner had we alighted and dismissed the car than he declared,
"I'm not going upstairs. Please, do me a favor. Go up and tell Elspeth not to expect me until late. Say nothing about the dragons, of course."
And what are you going to do? I asked, displeased at his request.
I've got something I must take care of, he said mysteriously.
And then, sensing that I was about to object, he pleaded quickly,
Go, please! Good Lord, am I to be bopped all my life?
I realized vaguely what he wanted to do, but his last words made me give in to his plea. And then, what good would it have done to have refused him? He would have put through his plan anyhow. The manner in which he clutched his camera under his arm and the light of fanatic determination in his eyes were indicative of a firm resolve. To go back to the ruined factory in New Jersey, no doubt driving there in his own little car, in the hope that the darling alligators whom he had nursed to health from their original heart trouble would return to roost there and he would be thus enabled to secure photographs of them. I let him go and regretted it, but I hold myself blameless, for short of locking him up behind iron bars, nothing could have restrained him. I went up and made some excuse to Elsbeth and then left to catch up on my own neglected work. Of the unsuccessful dragon expedition, I said nothing to anyone. To have done so would have been to expose Crabshaw. I was rather surprised to find that the professors at the university suspected nothing of his connection with the disaster in Atlantic City. But on second thought, this was only natural. Such a connection must have appeared extremely far-fetched, and to have propounded it would have been to expose oneself to ridicule if it were proved false, and again to ridicule were it proved true. In any case, the great publicity would have been Crabshaw's. Such must have been the motives of the professors in keeping quiet, if indeed they had any thoughts on the matter at all. Afterwards, true enough, all sorts of crazy things were propounded by professor and layman alike, and Crabshaw's name was mentioned. But those who had been in a position to assure themselves of the justice of Crabshaw's claims and had neglected to do so had nothing to gain by speaking up, on the contrary. When I called up Crabshaw on the afternoon of the following day, Elsbeth answered, extremely agitated.
What do you know about this? She asked. Where is Paul?
Why, didn't he come home? I asked, my heart sinking at the thought of Crabshaw alone with the dragons.
No, he didn't come home, she answered. But that's not what puzzles me so much as where he's been. I'm afraid there's some sort of hoax afoot. Since yesterday, I've had 3 cablegrams, ostensibly from him, all sent collect.
Cablegrams?
Yes. One from London that came last night. The second one came early this morning and was from Alexandria. And I just had another, just this moment, from Singapore, Malay States.
Well, what's he say?
He says the same thing in each one. Don't worry. Stop. Am safe. Stop. Be home soon.
Well, that sounds encouraging, I said, for want of any better comment. Elsbeth, however, declared,
Well, I can tell you this. I don't believe they come from Paul. He can't be all over the world in one night, and I'm not going to pay for any more of them. Perhaps you can tell me what it's all about. What did you two do yesterday?
Why, nothing, I said, and blandly made whatever excuses I could think of quickly, and then hung up. Actually, of course, I had a good notion of what had happened. It was plain that he was riding through the clouds on the back of one or the other of his flying alligators, and could stop them where he pleased, flying from continent to continent and over the oceans. Well, glory be to you, Paul. Now you are truly vindicated. Now you have your apotheosis. All the world will bow to you when you come alighting in the middle of Broadway on your pet dragon. I thought for a moment of proclaiming the arrival of Paul Crabshaw from a round-the-world hop done in one day. But fortunately, I thought better of it, in view of the recent disaster at Atlantic City, of which the papers were now full. But I could not restrain my mind from waxing enthusiastic over the fact that it was plain that Paul had tamed the monsters. What would not mankind be able to do with these domesticated dragons, who were so superior to airplanes? Perhaps Paul had struck the right tack, the new road along which mankind was to progress by breeding or otherwise developing animals to do the work of machines. But we waited in vain for Paul Crabshaw to return. Elsbeth paid for several more cablegrams from South America, from Africa, and from other outlandish places. Then the cablegrams ceased, which both pleased and disappointed the economical Elsbeth. And after that, we never heard of Paul again.
As for the rest, it's history. The brute of the Atlantic City disaster died down, and for several years we heard nothing more of monsters. Elspeth, bereaved, had gone away to nurse her sorrow, and Paul Crabshaw's disappearance was soon forgotten. I used to ponder over the probable fate of the dragons. Evidently, their mighty hearts had given way, and they had fallen into the sea, along with their doctor. But they had only retired to remote regions, there to breed thousands of their kind. For soon, the world awoke to the fact that it was positively infested with dragons. There were at first rumors of dragons devouring the Negroes of interior Africa. That was presumed to be false, like so many other jungle stories. And then there were rumors of dragons in South America and China. These were dismissed as tropically overheated imaginations and mere Chinese fantasies. And then there were dragons in Europe, in France, in England, in the United States, right here in New York. And no one could doubt the truth of it anymore. The world was a prey to man-eating dragons. Too late then to fight the vermin that had obtained such a foothold in our world. Alas, no longer our world, but the world of the dragons who have become supreme. Step by step, we have retreated and given up the globe which we had brought so near to complete civilization, given it up to our successors in time. The human history of the Earth is closing its books. Too late then for me to tell what I knew, and when I did, I found no one to believe me. No one would try my simple explanation and see if alligators could really be cured of their heart trouble and become dragons. The mere suggestion was dismissed at once on the grounds that acquired characteristics were not inherited, whereas these dragons bred true. In short, the idea was too ridiculous to be discussed seriously. The explanation that science handed down was that some dragon eggs, remaining for millions of years in the cold storage of the Arctic, had, by chance, been caught in the sweep of a glacier, had been carried down in the slow glacial movement to the sea, had thence, along with an iceberg, been carried off to sea and had floated down into the warmth of the tropics. On some tropical island shore, the dragon eggs, still by miracle unbroken and unspoiled, had slowly been brooded to life by the warmth of the sun. This theory fitted in well with old tales of gigantic rock eggs and was generally accepted by science and laity alike. I did not press my point, for what could be the value, at this late date, of knowing how to transform a comparatively harmless alligator into a dragon? Making more dragons, even in the name of research, was the silliest ever of all schemes to carry coals to Newcastle. Why, the world was full of them. Not a city, not a village, not the remotest hamlet, but suffered its depredations. The dread fowl came down like a hawk upon chickens and carried off men, women, and children, as well as cattle, and left only its horrid droppings as a final insult to the tragic survivors. In vain, mankind prayed. In vain, ministers sermonized on the beast of the apocalypse, the beast whose number was 666. In vain, we turned to anti-aircraft guns, to explosive bullets, to poison gases, to gigantic traps. In vain, our most courageous aviators mounted the skies in pursuit of them. A thrash of their tails, and man and his machine tumbled to the earth, while his bullets rattled harmlessly off the armor-like hide of the beast. It was useless to fight. We were beaten. And the wise ones were those who scurried off soonest to the best caves and mines. Farmers burrowed underground and tilled their fields in the darkest nights, and did not trouble themselves to grow any more food than they could use. Famine added itself to the miseries of mankind. Our supply of coal gave out. Our electric powerhouses ceased to function. Turbines still ran while there were volunteers to brave the danger of running them and of repairing the power lines. As long as our machines still held together, they were used. But repairs grew more and more impossible. To work in the daylight was suicidal. At night, light was forbidden, for it immediately attracted a dragon out of the sky. Evidently, they bred rapidly. Not 20 years after Crabshaw's first specimen, thousands were counted. And the world of human life perished before their insatiable hunger, as once the world of animal life had perished before our advance.
What we had done to buffalo and passenger pigeons was repaid by us in full measure. Oh, where is now the St. George that is to rid us of our scourge? Where the scientist with serum or inoculation that should wipe out these dragons? What? Will science fail us? Are we doomed? We, the last remnants of the human race who now exist in perpetual fear? At first, how many and how bright were the reports of what we would do to the dragons? Reports of new types of guns, of great steel spring nets, of new and most potent gases, harmless to man but deadly to the great saurians, of disease germs that were to be spread among them and wipe them out in one vast epidemic, of poisoned bait. Alas, all failed, until even the most optimistic of us have lost heart. We ceased to hope and made the best of things, and quietly blessed those valiant old New Yorkers who had constructed that so often ridiculed megalopolis with its impregnable fortress of skyscrapers and its marvelous network of underground passageways where we, besieged mankind, can make our last stand. Here, we are safe for a time. That is to say, until famine gets us. We stave off that as best as we can by utilizing every rooftop and planting countless window boxes and developing whatever mushroom and other fungus growths will thrive in the dark. Here and there, too, we grow food under ultraviolet light, but current is almost priceless. How long can we last, seeing that our existence is ultimately dependent on the constant excursions of volunteer corps who are ever risking their lives for the community? Our numbers grow daily less. A few, we are told by rare travelers, survive in the far north, where dragons rarely go. A few survive in scattered mines. No doubt there must be other communities, say in London and Berlin and other places where there are extensive subways, but it's years since we've had any communication with them. What is to be the end of all this, I ask myself? Are we to perish utterly? I think I shall cause this tale to be engraved on stone, so that if ever the human race arise again, it may read and know how the damnable inferiority complex of one Paul Crabshaw made all mankind the prey of fabulous monsters. That was The Day of the Dragon by Guy Endor. Guy Endor was an American novelist and screenwriter. He is most well known for his novel, The Werewolf of Paris. He passed in 1970. Good Lord, I just love these stories. I'm so bored with the people championing bad science today. You know what I'm talking about. All of the easily disproven BS that you see your crazy aunt post on Facebook. Yawn. It's so trite, so overplayed. You know what I want to see in the headlines? Disgruntled professor creates flying dragons. Human brain survives machete transplant into dinosaur skull. Seriously, guys, how hard is it? Just get creative. If that headline doesn't result in a spit take, then you're not working hard enough. In any case, I'd like to extend my rather posthumous thanks to Warden Alan Curtis and Guy Endor for the stories tonight. Thanks also to you all for joining me. We'll have some more Horror Hill for you next week, probably not lousy with reptiles like this one was, and I hope to see you then. Stay spooky, friends. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media
and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.